All right, we're beginning here on the top of Memvav Amud Aleph by the two dots. Tanur Banan, Nutchalfu lo kelim bikelim bebeit uman. If he got his object mixed up with another party in the craftsman's shop, for instance, you bring in your dry cleaning, and you end up getting back someone else's dry cleaning. It's a common occurrence. So the same thing over here. You gave it to the koveis, you gave it to the shoemaker. Whoever you were using as your craftsman, he returned the wrong object to you. You can utilize whatever he gave you until the other party comes to collect that which belongs to him. Regardless, we're going to have to explain that. Bebeta avel ubebeta mishte. If it happens in the mourner's house or it happens at the wedding, there you're not allowed to utilize it in the interim until the other person comes to collect it. This is a more common occurrence than the other one, which is you go to shul and you have your coat and someone else takes your coat home and then you see why they made the mistake because their coat looks exactly like yours. So you take their coat in the meantime. Are you allowed to use their coat in the meantime? That, it says no. Where there's a mix-up between the items, there you're not allowed to utilize it. By the uman, you are allowed to utilize it. The question is, why should there be a difference between the two cases? Maishna Reisha, Maishna Seifa. What's the difference between the Halacha and the Reisha and the Seifa? It is under the rubric of what is otherwise known as Shoel Shalomidat. Borrowing something without the other person's permission, which as the Rashbam notes over here, Ve'asur Lishtameh Shalomidat. Shoel Shalomidat is a sword to utilize. V'chein Halacha. That's the way we paskin. So in these instances, you are basically a borrower without the knowledge of the owner of the item. The owner of the item has no idea that you have this item, and therefore you should not be allowed to or be able to utilize the item because that is a shoel shlamidat. So the latter half of the braita is clear and easy because there you're not allowed to utilize the item. The difficulty is in the resha of the braita, where when you get the wrong dry cleaning back, it seems that you're allowed to use it. So Gemara says, Amarav, I was sitting in front of my beloved. When Rav refers to Chavivi, it's his uncle, Rabbi Chiya, which is interesting also because Dodi, or Dod, is an uncle, but it's also my beloved. So when he refers to Chavivi, he's referring to his uncle, Rabbi Chiya, who was very influential in his life because both of Rav's parents eventually passed away. Rabbi Chiya is Rav's Rebbe. He also petitions for Rav in front of Rabbi to get Rav's smicha. It doesn't work out perfectly. But Rabbi Chiya is very close to Rav, and we see conversations between them all over Shas. So he says that, I was sitting in front of my uncle Rabbi Chiya, v'amar li, chin adam asui lomar l'uman, mechor li taliti. Doesn't a person say to his craftsman, can you take care of this? Can you sell this for me? So the shoemaker, you go and you have an old pair of shoes, you say, you think you could sell these for me? You go to the tailor, and you have a piece of clothing, you say, maybe you could sell this for me. That the craftsman not only acts as an individual who's fixing or doing work on the items, he's also a broker of sorts with these items. Since many people come to him with these items or looking for these types of items, he also becomes a clearinghouse for these items. Because of that, their possibility here is that the mix-up happened because of this. He sold an item. Somebody came to him and said, listen, can you sell this shirt for me? And he did. He sold the shirt. But when it came to delivering the shirt, he delivered your shirt instead of the person's shirt who he had sold. So now you ended up with the shirt that was supposed to be sold, that's been given to you. In the meantime, your shirt is with the buyer who bought the shirt from him. In that case, you're allowed to utilize it because the shirt, in a sense, belongs to the uman. It belongs to the craftsman. The craftsman didn't, by mistake, give you this shirt. He gave you this shirt intentionally. If the craftsman would make a mistake and give you something or give you the wrong item, it'd be no different than Beit Avel or Beit Mishteh. So in the case of the dry cleaning, where they mix up the clothing, that truly is a mistake. They're not giving you someone else's dry cleaning because they gave your dry cleaning to someone else. It was a mix-up. And because there's a mix-up, you would not be allowed to utilize it. What we're saying here is that where the uman intentionally gives you the object, you would have permission to use it. Why would the uman intentionally give you the wrong object? Because by mistake, he gave your object as the sale item. He sold the object, and then instead of delivering the object he sold, he delivered your item or your object. You gave him a shirt to fix. Someone else gave him a shirt to sell. He sold the shirt and then delivered your shirt instead of the person's shirt who he's supposed to sell for. So in the interim, he has to get it back, but he doesn't want to leave you without a shirt. So he intentionally gives you the shirt that he was supposed to sell. Given that, that's why you have permission to utilize the shirt, because it's not a mistake anymore. It's intentional. He's giving it to you in order to use in the interim. You can make that assumption, even though there's uncertainty over here. There's a possibility he's just making a mistake. There is a possibility that he's giving it to you intentionally. Given the possibility that he's giving it to you intentionally, that's what gives you the right to utilize it in the interim. Seems like that's enough of a reason to say that you can make an assumption that it's possibly not Shu'al Shalom Idat here, and therefore you can utilize it in the interim. There is logic to it. I think Ichil's question is a fair question, which is, what type of probability do you need of this being the circumstance in order to permit you to do this? Does it have to be the rov of pe'amim when they give you the wrong item, they're doing it intentionally? Or even a miut of times, is that enough to take away the issue of Shoel Shalom Idat? Now, as far as the trigger for return, both times the Breita says, Ad shivo hala v'itole shalo, till the other party comes and takes that which belongs to him. So once the other party shows up and says, can I have my beged back, you have my item, you're obligated to return it to him. How soon do you have to return it to him, and what can you do with that beged? What's clear here is once he asks for it back, and now you know that you have someone else's beged in your possession, you must stop using it. You can no longer get hana from it. The only question is, can you hold it as collateral until you get your stuff back? That turns out to be a machloket amongst the Rishonim as to whether you have to immediately give it back when he demands it, and you can't hold it as collateral because it's just not yours, and you had no right to have it in your possession. So you can't hold it as collateral until you get yours back. Or do you have a right to keep it as collateral, even though you can't utilize it, but you could still use it as collateral until the other person brings your coat back? So in the mix-up scenario, can you demand that he bring your coat back that you left in shul that he took before you return his coat to him? Or once he comes and makes a demand for it, do you have to give it back to him immediately because it's his coat? You don't have a right to hold it. You have no right to have this in your possession at all. So that is a question amongst the Rishonim when the Gemara says, Ad shivo hala v'itole shalo, what right does the person coming and saying, I want it back, and it sounds like he can walk off with it immediately? How immediate that is this machloket. But everybody agrees, once he makes a demand for it, you no longer can utilize it, because now it's clear, if he was an uman that gave it to you, that he gave it to you by accident. It wasn't intentional, and therefore you have no right to use it anymore. Of course, by Beit Avel, Beit Mishteh, you couldn't use it anyway. Even beforehand, now you also would not be able to utilize it. Even though that he may not be the party to the problem, which is that you give him his back, doesn't mean you'll get yours back, but you may hold it to pressure. People do that all the time. They hold on to something so that someone else has a vested interest in their interest as well. So Amar Rav Chiya Breid Rav Nachman, now we have qualifiers to this. Lo shano elahu. That's only if the uman himself gave you the object. Aval yishto banav, lo. But if it's his wife or children, then not. So here, it's clear that when it's wife and children, a mistake was made. When it's clear that a mistake was made, it's no different than Beit Mishteh u Beit Avel. So even though by the uman, he could also have been made a mistake, but there is that other possibility that he did it intentionally. So only because you have both of those options by the uman, a possibility he did it intentionally and gave you the wrong beged to hold you over until he could get yours back, or because he made a mistake, there it gives you the right to utilize it. But when his wife or children give it to you, there's no way they're giving you the wrong beged intentionally. There, it's clearly a mistake. If it's a mistake, it's no different than Beit Avel, Beit Mishteh, you're a Shol Shalom Idat, and you will not be able to utilize it. A wife and the children who may be involved in this may not be involved in the business, but they are not at the front. They're not serving the customers. It's the opposite today. The wife is serving the customers, and the husband's in the back. Back then, the wife would not have interacted with the customers at all. The assumption is that if the wife or the child acted, they're just trying to facilitate the person getting his item back. They don't really know what's going on in the business. Given that, it's likely a mistake. It's no different than Beit Mishteh, Beit Avel. The uman, he can make a strategic decision to give you the wrong beged. Again, assuming that it's his beged. If he gave you the wrong beged strategically because he gave someone else the wrong beged, that'd be no different than Beit Mishteh, Beit Avel. The only reason that the uman giving it to you gives you a right to utilize it is because he might own it. It might be his now because he's selling it on behalf of that party and he sold it already. And so since it's his now, he has the right to give it to you to utilize in the interim. Behu nami lo amran. And the uman himself also, ela damale talit stam. if he says to him, here, here's a talit. He uses some language that is somewhat ambiguous in the return of the object. Aval talitcha lo. If he specifies that I'm returning your talit, that does not work. Because then he is saying, this is your shirt. This is your suit that I'm returning to you. Then he is opining on the fact that he's returning to you that which was owed to you. He's not just trying to hold you over. If he says something much more neutral or ambiguous, where he says, here's a shirt, here's a suit, then you could suspect that he's giving it to you to hold you over, and you could utilize it, because otherwise he would have said, this is your shirt or your suit. And when he does say that, then we believe him. And if he gave it to you anyway, and it's the wrong item, then we assume he's making a mistake. Because, I love talit idehu. Because if he says, this is your talit, this is your clothing, and you know it's not your clothing, there's clearly an error that was being made over here. And again, even if he's doing it intentionally at that point, and claiming that it is your talit, in all likelihood he doesn't own it, he's trying to exchange it with someone else's, and there's a lot more to worry about, or suspicion that is aroused in this situation, because of the fact that he called it yours. Amar Leah Abaye LeRava. So now Abaye poses a question to Rava based on what we just saw in the Braita. Tach vilach ramai de pumpadita. But let me show you what these tricksters, cunning, guile merchants in Pumpadita do. Nature of who these individuals are is not clear from the Gemara. The easiest way to read it, and that seems to be the way the Ashram reads it, these were merchants. These were people who were craftsmen in Pumpadita, and they acted inappropriately because they were wise to the halacha. And that they were smart enough to know the rules, and they used the rules to their advantage. What exactly Abaye is asking from Rava is not clear either. He's just pointing it out, or he's trying to get Rava to institute something to stop them from acting in this way. Again, the whole thing is unclear. The context in which all this happened and about whom it was said is unclear in this situation. My Avde, what do they do? So Rava is asking Abaye, what's going on? Amalei, Havli Sarbalai, the individual, Abala Bayit, we'll assume here, gave some item to the Uman, to the craftsman. Sarbalai is a cloak or a heavy cloak that he gave to the craftsman. And he says, can I get it back? I want my item back. Lo yu dvarim le'olam. Craftsman said, I don't know anything about that. Don't know anything about your cloak. Ha'it li sadeh dechazu agabeh. I have witnesses that saw that you have it, that it's in your possession. The owner says that. Again, here, we're assuming an owner-craftsman relationship. It could be true of an owner that dropped it as a picadon by another party, that he deposited it with a friend. All of those are possibilities about the scenario that Abaye is describing. I'm just assuming, given the context in our Gemara, that we're talking about a Baal HaBayit and an Uman. He gave the cloak to the Uman to deal with, and always comes to collect it or pick it up, and the Uman denies that he ever had it. The individual says, I have witnesses that saw it in your possession. Amalei, how achrina hovu. He says, that's a different one. That's someone else's. Afkinei v'nachzinu. Bring it out and look. Let me take a look at it. And I'll tell you whether it's mine or not. Let me have a tviat ayin on the object. Amalei, ivra. This is the truth. Lo mafikin ele. I'm not bringing it out to you. Meaning that, absolutely not. I am not bringing this out. You're not going to get to see it. Amarova, shapir ka amarlei. The merchant is acting within the bounds of the law. What he's saying is correct. Ra'a Tanya. We had in the Braita the word Ra'a. Right, so let's piece together the conversation and understand what happened over here. The Baal HaBayit comes to claim his object. When he comes to claim his object, the Uman denies ever having it. He says, Lo ayu dvarim me'olam. It never happened. The question is he believed to say such a thing? Lo ayu dvarim me'olam. An Uman, can he make such a declaration? The answer is, it depends on what we saw yesterday. That was the machloka between Abaye and Rabba. Abaye and Rabba argued about what type of evidence do you need in order to block the Uman's ability to make a claim like that or to have a migo that he is believed. So over here, you do not have seemingly witnesses that you deposited it with him. So from Rabba's perspective, this isn't even a case. Abaye l'shitato said yesterday that if you know that the Uman has your object, then the Uman does not have a migo. Because once you know he has an object, or has your object, he can't say, Chagzarti lecha, I returned it to you. So over here, you have witnesses that say they saw it. So that would present the problem in Abaye's Shita. If the witnesses said they saw it, the Uman should not be believed anymore. That's where the Baal HaTosafot jump in and say that the witnesses that saw it, Perush, Talit shaya bosimanim ke'ein sheli. They saw a talit that has similar features to the talit that is mine. V'lo shaya lehem tviut ayin. But not that they were certain that this was the talit of this particular individual. Tviut ayin, which is, you have a sense that it's your shirt, not just with the simanim, but you have a connection to the item that you're certain that it's your item. It's a higher standard of identification than simply simanim, which could be common to a number of items. So he has quasi-evidence that this individual has his talit, but not definitive evidence. That's what makes the case different. Because if he was able to see it himself, and he would say, this is mine, the Uman would not be believed anymore. He would lose his Migo, because here is an individual identifying his object, and the object is with the Uman. That would give him rights to demand that they go to dinner, that they show the object, and the Uman would not be believed by a Migo. On the other hand, here you have witnesses saying that they saw something that looked like the talit of this other individual. It had similar features, but not that they could take a shvuah to the effect that it was his, or identify it definitively as this other individual's. That's the way the Balei Tosafot deal with it. The Rashbam, on the other hand, mentions that Beged Achad Ra'u Vushali Umiyu Eidim Ein Makrim Bo Yafeh Imu Zehu. So the Eidim aren't absolutely certain. They saw a Beged, and he says it was mine, but the Eidim themselves can't be certain that it was actually his. The way the Rashbam says it's simply that the Eidim have uncertainty as to what they saw. Balei Tosafot say they had simanim, but not tviut ayin. The Rashbam simply says that they just weren't certain. They didn't get a good enough look at it. They weren't absolutely certain about what they saw, or that they could identify it as his beged. So over here, there's uncertainty on what they saw. That is what opens up the opportunity for this uman to, quote-unquote, lie over here, or make a demand, shelo yu dvarim me'olam. Because now we have no evidence of the fact that they actually saw it. And that is what Rava's answer is in the end. Rava says the Braita from yesterday, and the Braita from yesterday is what triggered the part of the machloki between Abai and Rabba, which is Ra'a Avdo Biyad Uman, Vitalito Biyad Koves. Omer lo, Mativo Etzlecha, what's my stuff doing with you? Tamachartuli, Atanatatuli b'matana. You sold it to me, you gifted it to me. Lo Amaklum, he is not believed. What Rava points out over here, it says, Ra'avdo biyaruman, vitalito biyad koves. The demand is that you saw it. The demand is that you need to be at ayin. You have to be absolutely certain it's your beged in order to trigger this being the case. So given that Rava makes a demand of Ra'a, what's very interesting or ironic over here is Abaye is the one whose opinion is that Ri'iya is the pivotal issue as to whether we believe the Uman or not. That's what Abaye said yesterday. That's what he argued on Rabba about. Rabba said Edim, and Abaye said Ra'a. In the end, we saw that Rabba agreed to Abaye, at least in part. We don't know how much or how far, but at least he agreed in part. But Abaye is the one who had that opinion. Rabba brought support for Rabba's position against Abaye, and that's what we discussed yesterday. Rabba's question, did he really identify with Rabba's position? And he was questioning Abaye. In that case, you would have to say now that Rava reversed his position and now agrees with Abaye after Abaye brought the answer. Or was Rava simply yesterday learning the Braita? And in learning the Braita, he says, oh, you know what? This looks like a question on Abaye and a problem for Rava. Not that he believed or identified with the position that was in the Braita. He was simply acknowledging that that caused a problem for Abaye. But he might have subscribed to Abaye's position all along. And now we see here that Rava does subscribe to Abaye's position, but even to more of extreme than Abaye. When he says Ra'a, he means you literally gotta see it and know it's yours. You need to have strong evidence of the fact that it's yours before the Uman loses his Migo over here. So Rava takes Abaye's Shita as if almost to an extreme, which is, oh, you want Ri'ya to be the pivotal thing? I'm gonna say Ri'ya means literally an identification of certainty in order to block the Migo of the Uman. So that's what's going on over here, the conversation between Abaye and Rava. Abaye is saying these people are acting inappropriately. They're refusing to bring out the item so that the person can identify it. Rava says they have a right to do that. They have no obligation to respond to every claimant. Any claimant who shows up, you have to come bring the thing out, you have to show it to them? No, only if they have a valid claim. And these people haven't brought a valid claim because they don't have enough evidence. the fact that the Uman is holding their item and therefore would be compelled to bring it out to show us. And the individual who is holding the item, or the Uman, says, I don't want to expose other people's property. I don't want to bring other people's property into the public. And we have that by the Ayin Hara that is associated with other people's items. You don't show off other people's items. You don't bring it out to the public. We saw that by the Avedot in Baba Metzia, because either you tempt the Ganavim, because now they know you have something in there that they might want, or the Ayin Hara, as people say, oh, this thing, wealthy individual, this item, there could be an Ayin Hara associated with it. So this person can make a claim, or this Uman can make a claim, I'm not bringing this out into the public venue in order for you to identify it, because first of all, you don't have a valid claim, and number two is I don't want to expose other people's properties to the problems that can happen when I bring it out, or people know that I have their property here. So given that, Rava says they have a fair claim, because they're saying, Ra'atanya, that's what we saw yesterday, that you need to know for certain before they are demanded to bring it out. Now the Balei HaTosafot here at the bottom say, of course, Ra'atanya, that's what's written in the Braita. So what is Rava adding about Ra'atanya? And what he says here is very interesting. He says that the Ra'atanya limits the Migo of the Uman. And he says, Nira lo lefaresh, hachi shapir kamar. When Rava says that these Umanim are acting appropriately and they're responding properly, klomar shotwein tanazo, lo ayu dvarim meolam, de'agid kach lo mishavi le ra'a. Because if he says that it never happened, then the ra'a, the identification of the item, was not sufficient for you to demand that he bring it out. I mean, that on one side you have the Uman saying, we have nothing to do with each other, I never took anything from you. And here you have the Baal Bayit saying that, I have witnesses who say they saw something like my item with you. Over there you don't have sufficient evidence to demand that he brings it out. You also don't have sufficient evidence to block his migo. And therefore when he says, lo yu dvarim ma'olam, he is believed because you have no evidence to the contrary when he denies any interaction with you. Aval iyavatayin lakuach ubiyadi. On the other hand, if he claimed that I bought it from you, lo ya ne'aman, he would not be believed. Zeinlo od migo. He no longer has the migo where he could have said, it was mine all along, or he could have said, I don't have it. That he can't do. Di ba'amar chegzarti lecha, olo yu dvarim olam. Because if he wanted to give the alternative, which was makes him believable over here, is that I returned it to you, or it never happened, so you should be believed when I say I bought it. That's not true. Di'arei lo markein, ho v'yesh edim sh'ut alit kotoshu shelo bi'adol. He's too scared to make that claim because he knows witnesses saw something similar in his possession. Remember, amigo relies on the fact that you could have made an alternative claim, and that alternative claim would have been better. If you're too scared to use the alternative claim, then your claim now is no longer more believable because it's too risky to utilize the other claim. We saw that yesterday in the Rashbam, where the individual says, you know what, I returned it to you with Eidim, just the Eidim are overseas. We said that that was not a valid migo because the guy would be too scared to make that claim because the Eidim will eventually show up and uncover his theft. So because of that psychology that he wouldn't use that claim, therefore we can't say he had a better claim because he wouldn't have used the better claim. And that's what the Balei HaTosafot say over here. That what Rava is pointing out is that Ra'a Tanya, that over here where your evidence is only quasi-evidence and not full-fledged evidence, that would be enough to block amigo in the case of where he says, oh, you know what? Yes, I bought it from you. Because over there, the alternative claims would no longer be good. I returned it to you, or that never happened. Can't say that because Edim are already saying that you have something that's similar and the person would be too scared to use those alternative claims. Since he's too scared to use those alternative claims, when he says, L'kucha yibiyadi, I bought it, he's not believed, because he loses his migo. On the other hand, if he says, Lo yu dvarim me'olam, he denies it completely up front, there he is believed, because we have no evidence to deny his statement. He's not acknowledging that he ever had the item in his possession. He's simply saying, I don't have it. I never had it. I will never have it. It's not yours. You have nothing with me. There he is believed, because they deem don't have sufficient evidence to counter that statement. In the other case where he says the kucha biyadi, which is already an admission that it is in his possession, then together with the quasi-evidence of the edim, it starts to limit his options about what he can say. Given those limitations, then he would not be able to use those alternative claims, and then he would not be neman to say the kucha biyadi. So that's the chiddush of Rava over here. The chiddush of Rava is that the umanim who say lo yud varim olam, they have a leg to stand on. Because had they said, they would not have a leg to stand on. But now that they said, lo yudvarim me'olam, they have a leg to stand on, and they do not have to bring the item up. So again, depending on what you think Abai was asking of Rava, Rava either says, there's no reason to institute anything over here, because they're following the letter of the law, they're not acting outside the letter of the law, or if it's a case where Abai is trying to point out that these individuals are thieves, and they're doing this as theft, Rava says they might be stealing, but we don't have any legal means to go after them because they're acting within the halacha over here. They're not acting outside of the framework of halacha. So what Rava is saying back to him, not necessarily in defense of their practice, but the fact that we can't do anything about it because they're still working within the letter of the law. Maybe they are thieves or maybe they are Ramayim, but they're really good Ramayim because they're utilizing the law to their favor, or they are utilizing their knowledge of halacha to benefit themselves. And therefore, their claim is a fair claim that they don't have to bring the item out. And again, in all these cases, it's clear that if the item was brought out and the individual identified it, then he would have no more claim, meaning that the Uman would have no more leg to stand on in terms of his believability, because we said before, as soon as you identify your objects with the Uman no longer has a right to say, Lakuach achi biyadi, I bought it from you, or lo yadvarim alam, obviously you can't say, because at this point, the relationship, the natural relationship between a Baal HaBayit and the Uman is one of depositing to be worked on and not of being sold, and he'd need witnesses or evidence to show that it was sold to him. It says now, if the Baal HaBayit is smart, he can change the circumstances so that he can see it. Meaning that he can make up a story in order to get the Uman to bring it out to him so that he can actually identify it. Why are you holding on to this beged? Isn't it because I owe you money? Basically, the Uman is holding it as collateral in order to extract money or extort money from this Baal HaBayit. So that would, again, as you see pieces of this unravel, it might give you more information about what exactly is happening here. The individual deposits an item with the Uman, comes to collect it. The Uman says, not here, never had it. Why is he making that claim? It's probably because he's trying to charge some exorbitant rate. And the customer says, no way, I'm not paying that. So the guy says, you're right, yeah, you don't want to pay that rate. I never saw your beged, I never had your beged. So now, what's the guy going to do? He has no way to get this beged back, because the Uman is saying, lo yudvar me'olam, he's denying it. And you have nobody who saw the beged with the Uman. All of that gives the Uman the upper hand. Given that he has the upper hand over here, he's not going to bring the beged out, because he knows that's good to his detriment. So what you say to him is, listen, why are you holding this beged? You're holding this as collateral because you want to get paid. You want money from me. Hashta afkino bishaminu. Why don't you bring it out and let's assess it to see whether it's worth the same amount of money that I owe you. Let's make sure that what you're holding actually is in lieu of the payment that I'm supposed to be making to you. Shokol atidach, mishkol ana didi. And I'll bring the money and I'll pay you. Just bring it out so we can be sure that the value is right. So all he's trying to do is bait him into bringing it out so that he can identify it. He has no intent of paying the money. He has no intent of paying this exorbitant rate. What he wants to do is change the halachic reality by being able to identify the beged. Once he does that, he'll force the Uman to have to now bring it to court or to answer to his claim in court. But he has no intent of paying him. He's just doing this in order to bait him to bring it out. So Rav Acha b'rei de Rav Avya, the Rav Ashi. So Rav Acha b'rei de Rav Avya, the Rav Ashi says, you know what? I don't think that's such a smart move. The Uman can say to him, I don't need your assessment. Kvar shamua kamay de kamach. I already had other people who assessed it and they told me it's fine. I got the right value here. Or the evaluation that was done has nothing to do with you. I know what the beged's worth. I don't need a professional evaluation. I don't need to bring it out. I mean that you could try to bait him, but if he's smart and he's playing the game, he's going to say, listen, I'm fine. The beged to me is worth exactly what you owe me. I'm not going to bring it out. I'm not going to respond to your claim over here. So given that, you won't get him to bring it out. But basically, the Gemara is saying that what you need to do is try to get a positive identification of the item. Otherwise, the Uman is going to have the upper hand. And depending on who is more guile or cunning, you might have the possibility of getting him to bring it out. Or he might always refuse to bring it out, and then you'll never be able to get the upper hand in this situation. But again, this is an extension of the sugya we spoke about yesterday, which is that the only thing that causes the Uman to lose his migo is if we know he has it in his possession. Knowing it, according to Rava, now means literally positive, absolute identification of the item. Right now, we move on to Next piece of the Mishnah, remember the Mishnah had a list of individuals who could not establish a chazakah. So we just dealt with Uman. The next one in the Mishnah is Aris, Len Lo Chazakah. Then in Aris, a sharecropper cannot establish a chazakah on the land. That's because he entered the land as a sharecropper, and sharecroppers will use the land. And they might act or look like a balabait, but they do that in their capacity as a sharecropper. Given that, we're not going to allow a sharecropper who entered the property as a sharecropper to establish a chazakah just because he's been there for 3 years. Amai? Why not? Adid na palga vashtakula. Should be easy to determine whether he's a sharecropper or he's the owner of the land, because until now, he only took a percentage of the output of the land. At the end of the season, you'd go out in the field, he'd take 50% of it, and he'd give 50% to the balabait. Now all of a sudden, he's taking all the produce from the land. He's taking everything. Isn't that a clear indication that the nature of his ownership over the land has changed? That until now, he was simply acting as a sharecropper, and that's why he was only taking a percentage. Now he's acting like an owner because he's taking 100% of the output of the field. Given that, it would be a positive way to create a chazakah. And the answer is, Rabbi Yochanan bar Issei Batei Avot. You're dealing with arisim sharecroppers that are permanent sharecroppers, meaning that they have a family interest in being a sharecropper over here. That means that the owner of the land can't fire them. On the other hand, they are obligated to continue to work the land as sharecroppers. It's somewhat akin to the feudal system later on that shows up in Europe, where there are individuals who are tied to the land itself. That you sold the land with the individuals on it that worked the land, and they were, in essence, sharecroppers. They didn't get a lot of pay or a lot of percentage, but it's something similar, which is that these individuals have some connection to the land, and a connection that the balabait cannot sever. They're there for long periods of time. Given that, you cannot establish a chazakah. Question is why? How are they different than a regular aris? According to Rashbam, the difference between arisei beit avot and the regular arisim are, no'agim le'achol kol perot bet v'gimel shanim. They used to eat the whole field for two, three years. Rachaken yuchlu abalim k'mokein. And then afterwards, the balim would take their 2, 3 years. So that it was different than sharecroppers who are there on a year-to-year basis. Given that they're there for a year-to-year basis, they want their payout on every given year. And so does the balabait. They want to get their percentage. The balabait wants his percentage because who knows if they're going to be here next year? Who knows what we're going to do in the following year? Arisei beit avot are going to be there for the long haul. They're going to be there always. So instead of splitting the produce on every given year, what they would do is say, you take 2, 3 years here, and then I'll take the next 2, 3 years. I mean, that they had to work all of those years, all 6 years they would work. They would just take 3 whole years for themselves and then give 3 whole years to the balabait. Given that, then even when they're functioning as a sharecropper, they're taking 100% of the output of the field, and therefore you can't identify the difference between them acting as a sharecropper and them acting as an owner. Now, the Rashbam's explanation is difficult, I would just suggest, because a sharecropper, or these types of individuals are subsistence farmers, tenant farmers. They do not have the ability to go around and say, 3 years I'll collect, and then the next 3 years you collect. What are they living off of during those 3 years? The previous 3 years? It's much harder for them. To me, it would seem much more logical that they want output on every year in order to live off the output of every year, rather than having 3 whole years and then having nothing for 3 years. LAMK, you say that they're doing this on multiple fields and they switch off between the fields. The Rabbeinu Gershom gives an alternate explanation, which to me seems more plausible, which is, Hacha be'arisei beit avot askinan kegon mishpachachat shemitchabrim v'kol echad notein aris sadeh achat kula gimel shanim ohei. There's a large family that gives all the properties of the family to these arisim, kedei sheyizrena v'yochol perotel, ubuto schar yishmor kol hasadot shel mishpacha. He takes care of large, large tracts of land, the whole property of all this greater family or of this estate. After 3 or 5 years, he's going to give it back to the owners. And then someone else gives him a field, the Gimel Shanim. So basically what he does is, he takes one field in which he gets 100% interest. For that 100% interest in that one field, he works all the other fields. Now, Rabbeinu Gershom explains it as being that these are states or families that are pooling their assets and putting all their fields together. You can see this happening with one individual. The one individual says, rather than taking 50% of the 10 fields that you're working on my behalf, 5 fields will be yours, and they'll be 100% yours. The other 5 fields, 100% will be mine. So the split, instead of being 50% of every parcel of land, becomes a division because you have a large enough amount that he's getting 100% of certain tracts of land. So therefore, he looks like an owner on those lands. And therefore, if he switches from being a sharecropper to an owner, you wouldn't know the difference because he was taking 100% before and now he's taking 100%. Now, why that's more plausible is because in every year, he's still getting output. He's still splitting with the balabai. It's just the nature of the split. Rather than in getting 50% of every item, he's getting 100% of 50% of the items. And because of that, he looks like an owner all along, and therefore he can't establish a chazakah. Amar Rav Nachman. So now we have a statement of Rav Nachman. Aris, shorid arisim tachtav, yesh lo chazakah. An aris who has other arisim working under him, he can establish a chazakah. My daimo, what's the reason? Delo avidinish, denachte arise darei vishatik. People don't allow someone to bring in sharecroppers to their land and be silent. Now the Rashbam over here suggests that the reason is because the aris is not working over here. He basically brings in other arisim to work under him, but he then doesn't work at all. So he starts to act like the landowner, like the balabait, where he stops working. He subcontracted it all out to all these other arisim. In that case, you can establish a chazakah, even with arise beit avot. Because no owner is going to allow his aris, who's supposed to be working for him, to sit around and watch other people do the work and then collect based on that. He said, basically what he'll do is he'll take out the middleman and say, you out of here and I'll hire these arisim directly. That's one possibility. That's the way the Rashbam seems to indicate. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here suggests that it is a situation or a case where the aris is working 50% of the property. And another 50% of the property, he hires arisim for a percentage of the property or the percentage of the output. So he will establish a chazakah if those arisim work on that portion of the land for 3 years. Because people don't allow an aris bring in other arisim to work under him in that circumstance. Because here he's working 50% and he's letting these arisim work the other 50%. Or in essence, he's acting like an aris on 50% of the property. He's acting like an owner on the other 50%. That part of the land that he's acting like an owner will establish a chazakah because of the fact that he is working the other half like an aris. Is a clear contrast between the way he's handling 50% of land and the other 50%, and that's what gives him the right to establish a chazakah in that manner. Others suggest that the problem is that he brought in new workers. I mean, if the Baal HaBayit knew about these arisim, it would be fine. But here he brings in independently arisim without the permission of the landowner. In all these cases, what the Rishonim are suggesting is these are not actions or activities that would be undertaken by someone other than the Baal HaBayit. And if a Baal HaBayit knew that someone else was doing this, they would definitely object, or they would put their foot down in these situations and say, no way, this isn't going to continue this way. The fact that we've had no objection, and the fact that he's acting like a Baal HaBayit, both of those make it clear that he is establishing a chazakah, or he must be the landowner of this property. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, aris shechalak darisim, in lo chazakah. An aris who divides up to other arisim does not have a chazakah. Now this will depend on what you said in the previous statement. Here the Rashbam was saying in the previous statement the problem and why the aris was able to establish the chazakah was because he wasn't working. He wasn't working and the other individuals were working. Over here what he says happened is he was working and the other arisim were working. That he brought in other sharecroppers to work with him, but he himself continued to work in the fields as a sharecropper. In that case, he can't establish a chazakah, because all he's doing is he's bringing other parties to help him, because it's too much work for he himself. As the Gemara says, Maitama imor harmania ba'alma shavua. That basically, he made him into an executor of the estate, or a foreman on the estate. I think the word harmania might actually come from the word foreman. It actually sounds very similar. He was the lead aris on the property. The Baal HaBayit, making him the lead aris on the property, expects him to bring in subcontractors to work under him. So he basically becomes a contractor, and then he's going to subcontract the work out to others. So for the Rashbam, that means that not only does he work the field, but he brings in others to work the field alongside of him. So that identifies him still as a sharecropper, but with the right to bring in others to help him. If he's standing aside doing no work, then he's no longer considered to be a foreman, then he's considered to be a Baal HaBayit. Because only Baal HaBayitim, or owners, don't work the field. If you're an aris, you're going to work the field, no matter whether you're the foreman or you're just the regular sharecropper. So that's the difference between the two cases according to the Rashbam. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom stated is that if the tracts of land are so large that he's unable to do the work all by himself, then in that situation where he hires other arisim to come under him, and actually he is like a contractor or a foreman that is bringing in all these other individuals, and when he pays out on the percentage of the field, He's paying out from all the tracts of land. He doesn't divide it up where he's working 50% and they're working the other 50%. And they only get their portion from that other 50%, but rather, he's taking all the fields together and giving them a portion or percentage out of the totality of the fields. There he can't establish a chazaka, because then he's acting like an aris on all of the properties. And even though there are other arisim working with him, that's normal because there's such a large portion or tract of land. But he hasn't subdivided the land where he's working as aris on a portion and they're working for him on the other portion, but rather they're working on the entirety of all the tracts of land along with him. And therefore, the percentages that are granted are not about a specific area, but about the entirety of the work that is being done by all the parties there. He's acting like a foreman, not like an owner of the field. He wasn't a reese, now he claims I bought it. And nobody said anything to me for the last 3 years. Question is, why didn't you say anything through the last 3 years? Is it because he was an aris, and that's why he didn't say anything, because he was acting like a sharecropper, and that's what his job was? Or did you not say something for the last 3 years because it belonged to him? That's what we're trying to determine. Was his behavior different than it was previously, where the Baal Bayit should have objected if there was really an objection to be had? Or was his behavior exactly the same as it was before, and therefore there's no reason to object? So that's what we said. A regular aris who takes a percentage of the crop, and then all of a sudden starts to take 100% of the field, the Baal Bayit doesn't speak up, that establishes the chazakah. He's now acting like an owner, not like an aris anymore. Whereas if he's continued to do what he did before as an aris, then you can't establish a chazakah that way. The Baal Bayit didn't object because he was acting like he was before. He was still acting like a sharecropper. So the lack of objection is not evidence to the fact that you might have bought the field. It's simply because you're acting in the same capacity you were before him. Sholach lei Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, Rav Nachman bar Yaakov, yilamdeinu rabbeinu. Rebbe, please teach us. Aris me'id o enu me'id. Can a sharecropper testify on behalf of the owner of the field? For instance, the owner is trying to demonstrate ownership over the field, or there's some other altercation or argument about the field. Can the sharecropper who has evidence or knows something, can he testify on behalf of the owner of the field that he is working for? Do we say he has a vested interest in the field, and therefore he can't testify because if the field's lost, he's going to lose his interest in the field? Or do we say that he's a sharecropper? Given that he's a sharecropper, he has no interest in the field itself. He simply wants his output from the field. So now, Tosfot over here just happens to point out that the question was posed by Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista to Rav Nachman bar Yaakov. And Tosfot over here makes a comment. We actually saw this together in Gitin, that's a machloket Rashi and the Balei Tosafot, as to who is the Stam Rav Nachman in Shas. When it says all over Shas, Rav Nachman, who was Rav Nachman's father? The Balei Tosafot in Gittin said it's Rav Nachman bar Yaakov. The Rashi in Gittin said it was Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak. The Balei Tosafot bring it up here because they say, this is my proof. That is Rav Nachman bar Yaakov. And his point is that throughout Shas, if you check carefully, Rav Nachman bar Yaakov's name is only mentioned when there is another Rav Nachman there in the case. Whenever the Shas mentions another Rav Nachman, it uses Rav Nachman bar Yaakov as an individual. You will never find Rav Nachman bar Yaakov speaking independently in Shas. You'll never have him speaking to another Amora, or you'll never have a Rav Nachman bar Yaakov speaking independently, being quoted independently. The only time Rav Nachman Yaakov's name appears in Shas is when there's another Rav Nachman there that is speaking to him or he's interacting with. Balei Tosafot would say, that's my proof. That Rav Nachman throughout Shas, Stam Rav Nachman is Rav Nachman bar Yaakov. Because the only time that the Shas goes out of its way to say Rav Nachman bar Yaakov is because it's a situation in which there's another Rav Nachman there. Therefore, they have to identify between the two different Rav Nachmans. But in a case where they don't have to identify between them, then they just use Stam Rav Nachman. And he also points out that in other places in Shas, Rav Nachman Yitzchak interacts with Rav Nachman Stam. And given that, it would be problematic, as well as the fact that Rav Nachman Yitzchak is a Talmud of Rava, and Rava is a Talmud of Rav Nachman Stam. So that would be problematic in terms of the timing. And therefore, the Balei Tosafot claim, here's one of my proofs. Shalach lei Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, Rav Nachman bar Yaakov. Rav Nachman bar Yaakov here is Stam Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman was one of the parties in the previous Gemara. So that's just a sidebar as to why Rav Nachman bar Yaakov is mentioned here and not Stam Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman bar Chista sent to Rav Nachman bar Yaakov, who the Balei Tosafot think is Stam Rav Nachman, Yalamdeinu Rabbeinu, teach us what the halacha is in this case. So Achi Amar Shmuel. So Rav Nachman now says the name of Shmuel. We know that Stam Rav Nachman actually was a Talmud of Shmuel. So that's more evidence to the Balei Tosafot's position. Aris Me'id. Aris has a right to testify on behalf of the owner of the land. Vatanya Enim Me'id. Don't we have a braita that says he does not have a right to testify? Lokasha, difference in the circumstances. Hadika Peira Ba'ara. Hadaleka Peira Ba'ara. Depends on whether you do have fruits on the land or you don't have fruits on the land. It means that if there is produce on the land, then the aris has a vested interest in keeping the land in the hands of the owner. Because if the owner is the real, is the rightful owner, he'll get his percentage, he'll get his payout. If he's not the owner, and then someone else comes and exerts ownership over here, he will get paid out, but yadav al atachtona. He'll get paid out as if someone went down shelo birshut. Those are the sugyas that we saw in the end of Bava Metzia, where someone enters the land without permission, works the land, and improves the land. What type of payout does he get? And there we said, yadav al atachtona. He gets the lesser of the benefit or the expenses that he invested in the property. So he does have a vested interest in the outcome over here, because if the owner that he worked for is the real owner of the land, he'll get paid out in full his percentage of the output of the land. If it's some other owner, he basically will just get reimbursed, or he'll get the lower of the shevach or the yitziah, and therefore it'll turn out to be a bad outcome from him. In that case, he's considered nogea b'davar, and he cannot testify. By the leka peir bara, in a situation where either he has not yet started to work, or he's already finished this year's work, over there he's considered to be an independent party. The reason the Rashbam says is that the Aris has plenty of work to find out there. There are plenty of other fields where he can go and work, and where people will pay him the same percentage. It's no skin off his back if this, he's the owner or someone else is the owner. Might be that the new owner would hire him anyway. He feels that he has ample employment opportunities. Given that, when he testifies on behalf of the Bala Bayit, he's not doing anything where he's no geba davar, because if he works on this field, he's indifferent between working on this field and another field, just speaking as a witness, trying to help out this individual, not because he's no geba davar, but simply because he believes that that is the case or that is the truth. So in a case where he has no monetary interest or vested interest in the property, he can testify on behalf of the Baal Bayit, despite the fact that they do have some pre-existing relationship. Obviously, we're not talking about Arise Beite Avot, because the Arise Beite Avot might have a vested interest in keeping it in the hands of that landowner, because if the other owner is the owner, that might sever their relationship with the field. If their relationship with the field is automatic and stays no matter who the owner is, over there they might be independent then, because then they might be indifferent as to who owns the land, because of the fact that no matter who owns it, they will always be attached to this land. So it depends on how you view Arise Bate Avot. Is Arise Bate Avot mean that they belong to these families and they work for these families in particular? Or are they attached to the land and they work these lands in particular no matter who the owner of the lands are? So depending on which way, then they might be or not be Nogea Bate Avot. I think that Rav Nachman's statement is a general statement. I think the judges in every case have to be careful, meaning that the Aris might get a higher percentage with this Baal Bayit, or the Baal Bayit might reward him with a higher percentage. You have to be careful about the relationship. What we're suggesting here, what seems to be is a case, the way the Rashbam is explaining is, that these are called freelance Arisim, or these are Arisim that work year to year. They're looking for work every year, and they get hired in this field or that field. They don't have a particular long-term relationship with any Baal Bayit. So given that, we don't assume that the relationship will create a negiyah over here. And he won't also speculate that maybe the guy will reward me. People don't lie or do things that are serious averot, like lying under oath or lying in court, in order to help someone out unless they have certain results from that. So if they don't have any certain results from that, they're not going to do that on speculation that they might get some benefit. Yes, the judge has to be careful, but we're talking about these cases in a generic situation in which we wouldn't assume that the Aris would lie in favor of the landowner because he has no monetary or vested interest in the property. Tano Rabbanan, Arif, Meid Lofe. Here we're going to go through a list of individuals who have relationships and whether they're allowed to testify for each other. Exactly your question. Aris, we're speaking about because it's the context of the Gemara. But now the Gemara moves on and says there are other existing relationships where you might think the individual is no Geba Davar, yet we're going to allow you to testify. For instance, Arev me'id lova. The Arev, the guarantor on a loan, is allowed to testify on behalf of the debtor. That's only if he has other property in his possession. Meaning that if the debtor has other property, then the Arev, the guarantor, is not worried about the loved defaulting, and then the creditor coming after the guarantor. Given that the loved has other properties, the Arev is in a safe position, and therefore he can testify on behalf of the debtor to keep more property in his possession. Because the more property makes no difference. He already has collateral and sufficient collateral that would protect him in the case of a default, because there are other pieces of the land or they had sufficient ownership that we don't worry about it. Whether it's free and clear property or encumbered property, the creditor goes after those properties of the loveh first, only comes back to the arev if there's absolutely nothing to get from the loveh. The arev is a last resort. Last resort means you've gone after all free and clear property of the loveh and any encumbered property of the loveh. You have a right to collect from the loveh to the fullest extent. If at the fullest extent you can't collect from the loved, then you go to the Arev. So as long as the loved has other property, whether he sells that property, no matter what he does with that property, the Arev is protected because the creditor can always go after that property. Given that, when he testifies on behalf of the loved to increase his asset base, it really makes no difference to the Arev. He's not benefiting from that. He's not considered to be nogea b'davar. Malve mei the loved, creditor can testify on behalf of the debtor. Again, as long as the debtor has sufficient property by which the malveh can collect from, the fact that the malveh now testifies on his behalf and gives him more assets or more property shouldn't make a difference, because the malveh sees in front of him sufficient property or sufficient means by which he can collect over here. Given that, he is not considered to be nogeh b'davar. Lokeach rishon me'id lokeach sheni. A primary buyer or first buyer can testify on behalf of a second buyer. That assumes that he has alternate or other property. So the lokeach rishon, the first buyer from any individual party, he has basically the first lien because he bought the property with recourse to the seller. The second buyer is subordinated to him. So that means that he's secure because if a creditor comes to claim or collect against the mocher, against the seller, he will have to go to lokeach sheni first. And after he goes to lokeach sheni, he will go to the lokeach rishon. Reuven owns numerous properties. Reuven sells a parcel of his property to Shimon, first lokeach, and then Reuven sells a second parcel of property to Levi, and he's lokeach sheni. It's a hierarchy in time. Who chronologically was the first buyer? The earlier buyer has the most protection, because the earlier buyer says, I left property for the creditors to come and collect from. So you can't come after me until you've gone and checked out all those other properties, free and clear or encumbered. Lokeach sheni is subordinated, which means that any creditor will have to go after the lokeach sheni first and then come after the lokeach rishon. Given that the lokeach rishon has a vested interest in seeing that the lokeach sheni keeps his property, given the fact that the creditors will come after that first. So that's what the Gemara says here. As long as the mocher, as long as the seller has additional property left, then the creditors are going to go after that property first, then only come after lokeach sheni, and then come after lokeach rishon. So increasing the asset base or keeping the property in lokeach sheni is only protective if the mocher has no other property. Because then he has a vested interest in lokeach sheni keeping the property, because creditors will go after that property first, then his property. On the other hand, if the mocher, the seller, has other properties, they're going to have to go after all those other properties before they ever get to lokeach sheni. And then when they get to lokeach sheni, they'll take from him and then go to lokeach rishon. At that point, we don't see he has a vested interest in increasing the asset base of lokeach sheni. And that's why he's not considered to be a geah b'davar. So therefore, the lokeach rishon can testify for lokeach sheni, because his keeping property in the hands of lokeach sheni is not necessarily beneficial to him. It does create a larger buffer, but there's enough buffer ahead of him, which is that there are other people who bought properties after both of them, or that the seller still has residual properties by which the creditors can go after. Given that, we do not worry about him being nogea b'davar by keeping a property in lokeach sheni. That's what the Balei Tosfot bring over here, Perush HaKuntzus, in the Rashbam says, Meshum dechai shem yavo b'chol v'yitrof imenu, v'lo yelo mother gavot min hamocher. Fear here is that the creditors will come after the second buyer, and if he doesn't have property, there'll be no buffer between him and the first buyer.
Now, why in all these cases do we not worry about the fact that there's possibly more outstanding loans possible over here, which is a real chashash that the debt outstanding is much greater than we would have expected. So therefore, the person does have a vested interest in seeing the assets be greater on the other party, because that way he is protected. So the Rashbam answers, because shnei chashashot lo chayish. We're not chushesh for multiple items. If you take reasonable precautions and you think that you're well protected, then once you add on properties on top of that, those additional properties you're not considered to be nogeh b'davar, because we don't worry about these far-fetched situations or these outlandish cases where there are huge debts involved. Meaning that we are chosheish for normal cases, but we don't expect someone to testify falsely or be nogeh b'davar when it is multiple iterations or chashashot away from the situation at hand. Therefore, we assume that the person is being impartial in those cases because of the fact that he's not thinking about those possible outcomes, and therefore he is testifying truthfully and not nogeh b'eduto. The Balei Tosfot also asked this question. Why don't we say here that you have a vested interest in increasing the asset base of any party that is in front of you. Whether he has other properties, whether there were later buyers of his property who will all be in line in front of you to be collected from, you might still have a vested interest just because you have no idea what the size of debt that this individual has incurred. Given that, you might be at risk even if you left property behind because the debts are just so great that they're eventually going to come after you. And the Re says in the end that we don't worry about it, but you have to then differentiate this from the case that we saw before. Before we saw a case by the Mocher and the Koneh, that we say that the Mocher is not allowed to testify on behalf of the buyer to keep the property in his hands, Shema, the possibility that he will have his Balei Chov, his creditors, come and take it away from this buyer. So therefore we said he can't do that. And there the Gemara doesn't give you the option to meet Le'Achrite. What happens if the seller has other property from which the Balei Chov can collect? How come over there we don't say that he's not considered to be Nogea B'davar if he has alternate properties from which they could collect? So that's what the Re says, that the seller knows how much debt he has outstanding. He knows how many creditors are coming after him. So therefore, he could be Nogea B'davar when he testifies on behalf of a buyer, because he already knows the possibility, or is aware of the possibility, that his debts far exceed the assets that he has now, and therefore they might go after this buyer, and he has a vested interest in keeping the property in the hands of the buyer, so that the lien of the creditor can be exercised on that property. On the other hand, over here, all the parties that are testifying are not aware of the debts of the other party, whether it's the Arev or the Malveh, and therefore within a reasonable amount, we would assume that they are Nogea B'davar, but once they have a cushion in their collection, like Arachrite, then we're not going to assume they're going to lie to increase the cushion, because they have no clue or understanding as to whether this person has larger debts or not. And that's why they're not considered to be Nogea B'davar when there is Arachrite by the Malveh and the Arev and so on. Whereas by the Mocher, he is considered to be Nogea B'davar, even when there is Arachrite. Then the Balei Tosafot go on to explain that they think that the issue, that the problem here by the Lokeach Rishon and Lokeach Sheni, has nothing to do with outstanding debts or Balei Chovot, creditors that are going to come out after them, but rather a problem whether the property actually belonged to the seller. And if it's found that the property was stolen, then there's going to be recourse against the seller. And that's what the Balei Tosafot say, the Chashash is over here. And he says that we don't say that by the Arev and the Malveh, because that they don't worry about these multiple levels of theft and recourse, because they think as long as the collateral is extant, that they are protected. So therefore, we do worry about it at the first level of chashash, the Balei Tosafot say, but we're not going to worry about that the arachrite is also possibly stolen, and therefore it becomes Nogea B'davar. That's not something that a person considers in his testimony, and he's not classified as being Nogea B'davar in those instances. So now, what the Rashbam points out is, and seems pretty obvious, is that the Lokeach Sheni can testify on behalf of the Lokeach Rishon. Lokeach Sheni is always subordinated to the Lokeach Rishon. Therefore, his testimony on behalf of the Lokeach Rishon doesn't do anything for him, because it doesn't provide him any protection. And therefore, the Lokeach Sheni can testify on behalf of the Lokeach Rishon, assuming that the Lokeach Rishon was sold the property without recourse. Because if the Lokeach Rishon was sold with recourse, then the Lokeach Sheni does have a vested interest. Because if the property is taken away from Lokeach Rishon, you know whose property is going. It's Lokeach Sheni's property is going to be the recourse, and it's going to be his protection. So as long as there's no recourse, then the Lokeach Sheni can testify on behalf of Lokeach Rishon. If there is recourse, then the Lokeach Sheni can only testify for Lokeach Rishon if there's additional property that would protect him and be subordinated to him that would be cover the recourse before they would get to Lokeach Sheni. Okay, now, Kablan. A Kablan is a guarantor, but different than a normal guarantor. It's called an Arev Kablan, where it's a situation in which the creditor has the right to collect either from the debtor or the guarantor. Meaning that he doesn't have to go to the exhaust all possibilities with the debtor and then go to the guarantor. He can choose at will to go to the guarantor or to the debtor. Rashbam does add in an additional dimension here about the Arev Kablan, that the situation is where the creditor gave the money to the Arev and then the Arev lent it to the Loveh. So that's why it puts him in line for the creditor to come and collect, because the loan was actually extended to this Arev Kablan and he acted like a contractor or a foreman in passing the loan or syndicating the loan and giving it to the Loveh, to the debtor. But most Mefarshim explained, just in a generic sense, that his type of guarantee here was an obligation to pay whether the Loveh defaults or doesn't default. So Amri la Me'id, v'Amri la Einu Me'id. We have different opinions as whether he's allowed to testify on behalf of the debtor or not testify on behalf of the debtor. Amri la Me'id, karev dami. Some say he testifies because he is simply a guarantor. Just like a creditor or an arev can testify on behalf of the debtor, so too an arev kablan can testify on behalf of the debtor. As long as the debtor has sufficient property by which the guarantor could go after that property if the creditor comes and collects from him, he doesn't care. He's not worried about the debtor. Therefore, increasing the asset base of the debtor is not a vested interest of his. He just knows that he has sufficient property there for him to collect from. He has a lien on that property, and he is happy. If he increases the assets of the loveh, it does nothing for him. It's not any better. So given that, he can testify. He's not considered nogeh b'davar. Because he's much happier if they both have property when the creditor comes. Because then when the balchov comes, he'll take that which he likes. So it's a little cryptic what the Gemara is saying. The Gemara is saying that the guarantor over here has a vested interest in beefing up the assets of the loveh, because that will open up the opportunity for the malveh, the creditor, to come and collect from either party. The way the Rashbam explains it is that the guarantor has numerous pieces of property. His property that's Zidit, Benonit, Ziborit, he has all different qualities of property, a hierarchy of properties. The loveh, on the other hand, only has one type of property, Ziborit, the lowest quality property. We know that the din is that a balchov is allowed to collect mi benonit. He's allowed to collect from middle quality property, even though technically min haTorah is only allowed ziborit. Shlotin el delit b'fnei lavin. In order to protect the liquidity in the market, the Chachamim instituted that a balchov can collect from benonit. So now the creditor shows up and he's looking at the possibility of collecting from the guarantor, collecting from the debtor. If he collects from the debtor, he's just going to end up with Ziborit. If he collects from the Arev, the guarantor, he's going to end up with Benoni property. So he likely is going to opt to take from the guarantor. Therefore, the guarantor has a vested interest in the debtor having larger amounts of property. The more property the debtor has, the more likely he's to have Benoni property, or to have property that's on par with the guarantor's property. Once he has that, or once that's true, then the creditor likely will be indifferent between taking from the guarantor and the debtor, and he will likely favor taking it from the debtor. So you do see that the Arev Kablan has a vested interest in beefing up the assets of the debtor in order to have the choice available to the creditor to be equal between the guarantor and the debtor. And for that reason, he is considered to be nogeh b'davar. The Balei Tosafot over here, Tema Mai Nafka Mina Iate Malve Tarif Et Shel Kablan Ati Kablei Tarif Et Shel Loveh. Why does the Kablan care whether he takes it from him or from the Loveh, and then he has to go and take it from the Loveh? Why is he not indifferent between these scenarios? So he quotes the reason of the Rashbam, which is that the Rashbam suggests that the problem here is the level or quality of property, and he rejects that. He says that that can't be the reason, because the Imkain Malveh Nami Lo Yoyid the Loveh. That's the case, then a creditor shouldn't be able to testify on behalf of a loveh. Then the case before where we had the creditor testifying on behalf of the debtor, but the debtor had sufficient property to pay him back, there we should also say that the malveh, the creditor, is nogeh b'davar, because he might want the loveh to have higher quality property. The loveh only has zibori property now. If he defends him in this case, or helps him in this case, he'll end up with benoni property, and that'd be to the advantage of the creditor. If you think that there's really a difference between the Benonit and Ziborit property, then you should make that a problem in all the other previous cases as well, not just by the Arev Kablan. And therefore, the Balei Tosafot reject that as being the distinction, because he says in the end, you're getting your value. Whether you get Ziborit or Benonit property, you're still going to get the value that's owed to you. You'll get more property of Ziborit or less property of the higher quality Benonit. But in the end, you'll get property that pays you back, and therefore people are not going to lie or go to court to lie in order to get the Benoni property versus the Ziborit property. That upgrade or that change is not valuable enough for someone to lie for it. It says, Mishum de'ichlufei Benonit leZiborit lo yid sheker de'mekom mekom yesh lo sheveh b'sheveh. Inami arachrit de'kul ishmaite ki'otze bo kamar. Or you have to say that throughout the sugya here, that the property that we say he has other properties similar to the property he has means identical, exactly the same. It's not an upgrade in property. That in the case of the Malveh and the Loveh, when he says he has other property, his other properties are the same as the property that which we are testifying about. Therefore, there's no vested interest in the Malveh getting this property to the Loveh, because he won't benefit from that. So then what is the problem? So he says, Mishum de Trichalei Milto, the Mekam Alei Bedina Vedaino. He doesn't have to go to court. If the If the creditor goes after the loveh and takes the money from the loveh, case is closed, the guarantor is off the hook, and everything's done. He'd much rather that than a scenario in which the creditor comes and takes it from the guarantor, and now the guarantor has to go and get it from the loveh, take it to court, get a deem, all the other trappings and problems that arise from having to collect from the debtor. He doesn't want that trouble. Given that, he would prefer that the loveh's assets are beefed up so that the creditor goes after the loveh and not after him. Because of the inconvenience and the difficulty that will be caused if he goes after the guarantor. Not that he won't necessarily get his money back, but it'll just take a lot of effort to get his money back. The easier way for him is for the loveh to be paying. Therefore, he has a vested interest in seeing the loveh's assets built up so that the creditor feels comfortable or is happy taking the property from the debtor and not going after the guarantor. That's why he's considered to be nogeh b'davar, according to the Balei HaTosafot. Okay, we're going to stop here, four lines down on the top of Mem Zayin Amud Aleph.